John Cleese is, of course, one of the comic geniuses behind Monty Python, A Fish Called Wanda, and the classic television series Fawlty Towers. He can also be a bit controversial, we'll get to that, and he's become something of an expert on human behavior, teaming up with his psychiatrist Robin Skinner to write books like Families and How to Survive Them, lecturing on psychology and management, making fun training videos for meetings. In this one, dressed in a lab coat, he describes a model of the brain.
Well, the Cots and the Tempertonies murk the group poses and overclock the Murgatroyds chooses, thus to feed his Grisabon and part of Isaac is together to moot sliver the antipedity, so fourth frame shows data vision and auditory slow perfection.
Okay, perhaps mocking a long-winded scientist, but in his new book, John Cleese cuts to the chase. It's called Creativity. It's about how the brain is often operating on a subconscious level when it comes to being creative. The book is subtitled A Short and Cheerful Guide, and John Cleese joins us now. Welcome back.
Nice to hear you again, Robin. How many times have we spoken together? Three? Four?
More than that. We must take this on the road again.
We should tour it.
We were so glad to see cheerful in the guide because you did a comedy show last month based, I think there's a lecture as well, Why There Is No Hope. Now, you wrote this before the pandemic.
Yes, I did. I've been writing it over about 10 years. Yeah.
Why is there no hope?
Because people want to be right. And the last thing anyone wants to do is to adjust their opinions. And I think ultimately this is going to destroy us. But it'll all happen after I'm dead. So I regard it basically as other people's problems, including, I'm afraid, Robin, yours.
Yeah, because here in the United States, we don't really know anything about that thinking, that people won't change their minds. So this is your thing. You have studied human behavior. You're fascinated by it. And you've got in this slim book, you've got tips from psychologists you admire or are now your friends. It's a very slim book.
Oh, no, it's a deliberate. I'll tell you why. Because you know that lovely phrase, I think it was Mark Twain. I'm sorry this is such a long letter, but I didn't have time to write a shorter one. Well, I had the time to write a shorter book. And I deliberately left out a lot of the stuff that you'll find in books about creativity by psychologists, because it's all very interesting that people who've traveled a lot in their youth are likely to be more creative, but it's not much use to you unless you can move backwards in time.
But I thought I was going to get to do a little Python and say to you, this is not a book. You would say, yes, it is. And I would say, no, it's not. It's a pamphlet and you're calling it a book.
It's a very small book. There was a nice lady on Radio 4 in England and she told me she'd read it in just over an hour. And I was very happy because I think with a lot of books, that most of the interesting stuff is in the first 60 or 70 pages and then they pad it out to 300. I'm just going for the people who want the key ideas and can't be bothered with the rest of it.
Let's get to some of them. You say the mind is always working. If you have a problem, you can't make it through, go to sleep. And the mind will work on it overnight.
Our parents would say, sleep on it. You see, there's a lot of wisdom there because your mind goes on working on it overnight. And I found often that if I'd written a sketch in particular, couldn't think of a good ending, and I'd sit there and then give up. And the next morning, within 90 seconds, I had the solution and I couldn't understand what the problems had been the previous night because it was quite clear what the solution was. And this happened a number of times, and I thought, well, this can only make sense if the mind's been working on the problem. Then I wrote a script with Graham Chapman, dear old Graham, and I lost it, and he would get cross with me when I did that because I was vague and always losing scripts. So I wrote the thing from memory, rewrote it, and then I found the original. I compared them, and the second one was better. It was neater and slightly clearer and slightly funnier than the first. And I thought, but I wasn't even trying to improve it. I was just trying to remember it. So my brain had improved it during the time it had been lost.
By the way, can you remember any of that sketch? It was on the Church of England.
Yes, it was to do with a sermon about Lot's wife being turned into a pillar of salt. And the pastor or the rector or whatever you would call him was doing the sermon. It suddenly struck him how extraordinary that was. You know, that Lot is suddenly looking at his wife who has become a pillar of salt. And it was was about his astonishment at this and how unusual an event it was.
You'd think that would have struck him earlier. That was quite a story.
That was the joke was that he just read this in the Bible like so many things. And people, once they read it in the Bible, they think, yeah, okay, fine. But if you actually think of the three wise kings following a star, and then they stop at Bethlehem and they look up and they say, yes, this is the stable that's right underneath the star. I mean, have you ever tried to stand right under a star?
You quote from cognitive scientists who you admire, Guy Claxton, Donald McKinnon, but also the great German organic chemist August Kekulé von Stratonitz, which I had to say that. He discovered the structure of benzene by staring at a wood fire.
One night he was sitting very tired, dozing in front of the fire, and the fire was crackling away, and he started looking at the flames, which seemed to be leaping out further than they usually did. And he suddenly saw them as snakes, just, you know, as a kind of almost a half dream. And then he thought that they were biting their own tails, and that, of course, formed a ring.
Mm.
And he realized that the structure of the carbon molecule was a ring. And it's extraordinary. I mean, Einstein said that part of his thinking was muscular feelings were part of it, part of his thinking. And Edison, who had more patents than anyone else in world history, he used to have his ideas sitting in a comfortable chair. He would, in his right hand, he would have some little metal balls, and he would sit with his hand just over the edge of the chair and a metal plate below it. And he would just start to get in this very dreamy mood when he felt that he was in his most creative mood. And when he actually fell asleep, his hand would relax and the ball bearings would drop onto the plate, make a bit of a noise and wake him up. And then he'd lean down, pick up the ball bearings in his hand and go on in that dreamy state till he fell asleep again. And that was the state in which he thought he had his most creative ideas. So you see, everyone thinks this is a bit woolly, and yet all the greatest scientists in the world confirm it's not woolly. It's the best way to be creative.
Yeah, it's just great tips and honed down for us. And John Cleese, as I said at the beginning, we were very glad to see cheerful. It's a cheerful guide because there are some in some corners thinking that maybe you are not. I just want to ask you quickly about some things that have been happening in England. It's been puzzling to some. First, there was the Fawlty Towers episode that was pulled from streaming platforms for a little while because a character used offensive language, including the N-word. You were upset when it was pulled. You said it was making it clear the character was an idiot. But then, and it's been a while ago now, it was 2019, but there was a big kerfuffle because you were bemoaning on social media that cities like London don't seem English anymore. And this was seen as an attack on multiculturalism. And people like Caspar Salmon were writing in The Independent, this is the guy, you, who stabbed English pomposity and institutions through the heart with glee, who mounted a blistering satire of racist, small-minded little England-isms in Fawlty Towers. So would you like to respond to people who are wondering what's happened
here?
The
big difference is to notice that there's a complete difference between race and culture, because you can choose your culture, you can't choose your race.
Are you against multiculturalism in London?
No. I'm just saying it's not very English, and that's by definition.
Are you still someone who skewers the lily-white Englishman, uptight, reserved Englishman?
Yes, of course. I mean, you only have to see A Fish Called Wanda to see the fun I was making of that. There was a lot wrong with the old English culture and a lot right with it, but that's the case with most cultures. You now have people saying, well, you can't really make jokes. Well, the point of humor is that it's about things going wrong and it's about imperfect people. If you write a character who's perfect, who's kind and wise and generous and thoughtful, all those things, that's great, but he's not going to be funny. Basil Fawlty, M.W.C. Fields might be funny, but they're deeply, deeply imperfect. And if you're going to say, well, we can't laugh at anything anymore, because it's being cruel to people whom you're laughing at. The answer is they don't understand that some teasing is very mean and awful, and we don't do that. And a lot of teasing is just affection. It's actually a bonding mechanism. But people who are paranoid and who think things can only be good, 100% good or 100% bad, are poisoning the atmosphere.
That's John Cleese. His new book is Creativity, A Short and Cheerful Guide. John, always good to talk to you. Thank you.
Nice talking to you too, Robin. Lots of love.
What was the last one? What would you just say?
I said lots of love. It's an old-fashioned expression which probably conveys deep condescension towards you as a woman, therefore as an inferior person.
John, thank you.
Take care. Look after yourself.
You too. Take
Bye-bye.
Care. Bye-bye.